Okay, after this long introduction on extra time, and this will be about extra energies. So the question here is, in some sense, from a perspective of new observatories like LIGO and Virgo, why could we be interested in GRB supernovae? Do they have some promise for extra energies, in this case in gravitational radiation? So the setup of my talk is I'll touch upon some highlights on the phenomenology as we know of today of GRB supernovae, and then proceed based on this phenomenology with a particular GRB hypothesis, and continue with a theory on catalyzing black hole spin energy by an ultra-luminous torus with some particular phenomenology that comes out of this, making aspherical supernovae, ultra-relativistic jets, and particular prospects for LIGO and Virgo. And going through this, of course, one might be tempted to ask, are there any applications to short GRBs? After all, their gamma ray emissions are fairly similar to the gamma ray emissions from long GRBs. And then as a near future application, can we use these LIGO and Virgo campaigns in combination with upcoming surveys in the ENM of the transient universe, in the optical and the radio, to map a transient universe in this combined ENM and gravitational wave window? Now, concerning the energies, an important element in the GRB energies is that it turns out they're much smaller than their isotropic equivalent energies. So Harrison et al. Discovered what we now know of as this achromatic light break. And as we all know, that introduces a geometrical reduction factor to the isotropic equivalent emissions. And so energies that are anomalously large, on the order of one solar mass, for example, are reduced by a factor of at least two orders of magnitude to more canonical energies, in this case in the gamma rays, on the order of 10 to the 50, 51 ergs. In addition, gamma rays, GRBs are now known to have various lower energy associated emissions, and that was discovered and put on the map by Beppo Sachs, a very successful Italian-Dutch perhaps, satellite.
85% of the money was Italy.
I'm not sure that 85% of publication are Italian, but anyway.
It sounded like a pretty good deal for the Dutch, actually. So what this Italian-Dutch enterprise did for us is to provide extraordinary accurate coordinates to GRBs through the detection of X-ray afterglows. And once you have accurate coordinates, you can move to your optical, and further, if you wish, on the radio, so you can do all sorts of interesting follow-up studies. And lo and behold, energies of much lower energies were discovered, indeed, in X-ray, optical, and radio. And so GRBs are much more than just gamma rays. Now, in addition, the, if you wish, the astronomical origin of GRBs was finally defined by an associated supernova. While initially in 1998, the association was with a fairly dim GRB, so that the association with the supernova was not entirely convincing. This picture changed dramatically in 2003 with a supernova detection as with a honest-to-goodness typical GRB. This is this famous April 29th, March 29th event. And remarkably, if you look at this more quantitatively, if we look at the spectra between the supernova of 1998 BW and the March 29th event, they're extraordinarily similar. Of course, the March 29th event was much further away, so if you take a spectra, it's much more noisy. But if you look at the shape, it's very similar to the 1998 BW, suggesting a fairly standard supernova associated with GRBs, at least much more standard than the gamma ray properties. Now, more recently, this was looked at in much more depth by going to the host galaxies. And an interesting observation, which was part of the discussions already in this workshop or program, was that the hosts are probably very low metallicity. And that is interesting because it has particular ramifications also for theory. If you have low metallicity, you expect stars to have much less strong winds, and so progenitors may be much more massive, and that in fact may have implications for black hole formation.
Do you have any idea what the numbers are on this? When you say low metallicity, are they all? They're not all low metallicity, of course, but how many of them have I seen and how many are low metallicity?
Well, I mean, if you talk about low metallicity here, it would be like 1/3 of a solar metallicity.
No. How many of them are in low metallicity of the hosts which are seen? Like, are they? They're not all in low metallicity hosts, right?
There was one case where people claimed that it was normal metallicity.
But it's very rare. Very rare, yeah.
But all the others are lower?
And since galaxies are always low metallicity, these small galaxies.
All the others are less than solar. But there's, a few that are. We saw that plot earlier in the workshop.
Yeah.
There's a few that were at 0.5, and between 0.5 and 0.7, there was 2 or 3. It's just that the one
that
was super solar could be much less than solar.
So it's fairly well established now. Now, from a somewhat schematic point of view, what do we expect to be the outcome of the life of a massive star in the form of a core collapse? Actually, more typically, what you expect is the formation of a neutron star, and if it spins, it's easy to identify a neutron star by looking for periodic emissions. But it doesn't always happen. If we go to 1987A, a object of continuing discussion as to what is the remnant, then this far what we have, it's dark and it's quiet. And the most naive conclusion from that is that it should be a black hole. Now, one question of interest, again, from a theory perspective, as well as an observational perspective, is what is the potential for energy emissions from such core collapse events? And in particular, I want to emphasize the analysis of the total energies. And in total energies, you have to look for all the emission channels that are conceivably at play in these events. This was, of course, very strongly illustrated in 1987A, which was sufficiently nearby such that the MeV neutrinos could be detected. Now, if you go back to the actual MeV neutrinos, which are plotted here as a function of time, their total energy was in the order of 10 to the 53 ergs. That's a huge amount of energy. And it's one of the things that one might call extra energies, as these are not directly seen in, say, the supernova remnants or in the supernova event itself. Now, the problem with MeV neutrinos, although they're energetically very important to the event itself, obviously, if you talk about such large energies, is that they're very difficult to detect in this energy range. And so you must be looking at very nearby events. And furthermore, the MeV neutrino flux seen by a detector here at Earth is going to decay with 1/square of the distance. Very simple conclusions. So there's no way you can expect to detect such an MeV neutrino flux from a cosmological or even a nearby, in the terms of a local universe, supernova event. Now, what about GRB supernovae? Well, if we go to the event rates, based on the beaming factor, we should expect to have about one event per year within a distance of 100 megaparsec. Now, if they are luminescent gravitational radiation, then the picture and the prospect for detection rather than the MeV neutrinos is quite different, because gravitational wave detectors are strain detectors, they're not flux detectors. So any prospect of detecting such an event will go with the inverse of the distance, meaning the sensitivity decreases to your event as simply 1/ the distance. So yes, if they are luminescent gravitational radiation, we may have a prospect of detecting these to much larger distances than the equivalent event for MeV neutrinos. So that's an incentive to take the question seriously. What are the prospects of making gravitational radiations from long GRBs? Well, just by way of introduction, the gravitational radiation have two polarization modes. This you can easily discover when you look at the linearized equations of GR. And a nice feature about this is that this has been fully confirmed experimentally by simply looking at the Hilst-Taylor binary. Okay, so within about 0.1%, by just looking at the evolution of the binary over more than 10 years, you discover that the luminosity predicted by linearized gravitational wave, in linearized gravitational wave emission, which is about the 0.6% of a solar luminosity, agrees with the observed value. So basically within measurement error. So that yes, gravitational waves exist, they carry energy, and the linearized theory of gravitational radiation is in good shape. Now, if we go to a core collapse event, what we expect to happen is the formation of some compact object with potentially matter surrounding it. That can be an accretion disk, it can be a torus, and it may be a fairly messy event, in fact, to the extent that the surrounding matter is very non-axisymmetric. Well, the same linearized theory that you apply in studying the Hilst-Taylor binary, you can apply to such matter swirling around a compact object. It's simply by looking at the mass ratio of the mass inhomogeneities swirling around the central object, that being small, that the linearized theory applies. Well, as you might expect, what you have to do is write down the appropriate mass moments. If your density is rho and you use your spherical harmonics, you can write down your mass moments, and then the luminosity in gravitational radiation goes as the square of the mass moments with the appropriate time dependence. And so you can derive an equation for the quadrupole luminosity. It has lots of standard quantities in it, like the mass of the black hole, the mass of the torus, and the angular velocity of the torus. This is a relative angular velocity relative to the black hole. And one parameter, needless to say, that parameterizes the mass inhomogeneities in the torus. I mean, if it's a perfectly rotationally symmetric object, of course, there is no emission. And also, since this is a positive quantity, it will go as the square of this inhomogeneity. And you can write out the details. But the point is that you have a formula here, in fact, that you can use to derive the luminosity based on, say, results from a numerical simulation. And note also that this luminosity tends to be fairly large. It easily reaches on the order of 10 to the 52 ERCs for a case that applies to GRBs, meaning your black hole mass is on the order of a handful of solar masses, and your mass inhomogeneity, say, is tens of a percent, say 10%, 20% of the mass floating around your black hole. So these are very large luminosities. In fact, they can easily outperform the luminosity in MEV neutrinos. So within the larger question of what is the total energy budget and what is the total energy emitted, this is an important element. Now, a second element, a question that comes to play is what is the source of the energy? You can make nice non-axisymmetric tori and let them radiate, but is the source of the energy the collapse? Is the energy liberated by falling into a deep potential well? Or perhaps is the spin energy of the black hole important? So that's a very large amount of energy, potentially, as I'll show in a moment, as well. So there are two sources of energy that are, in principle, present in the picture. And the question is important, which one will be activated? Now, in asking whether the black hole or the spin energy of the black hole is relevant, let's have a look at the observational status of spinning black holes. Thus far, what we can say, and it's something that is becoming increasingly convincing, I think, is that black holes that have matter surrounding it that is non-interacting with the black hole, so it's free to float around the black hole and, in fact, to track the geometry around the black hole, that matter actually appears to, or that picture appears to come at play, come to the fore if you look at observations in X-ray spectroscopy of matter around black holes, at least during an inactive state, meaning non-flaring, no jets, and so on. What you then find is that if the black hole, that there's a consistency between the theory and the observation, in the sense that if the black hole spins very rapidly, then the matter is allowed to float around the black hole very close to the event horizon. The formal way of saying it is that the innermost stable circle orbit is very close to the event horizon. So if that is the case, then that predicts that your line emission should be very broad also to the deep red. So if we look at, and in particular, if we look at ion lines, they should introduce emissions below the 4 keV. And, well, if you look at this now famous object MCG 630-15, in a deep minimum state, a non-active state, then as first discovered by ASCA and then later in a, confirmed by XMM, then indeed we find spectra that have this tilt such that you have detectable emissions below 4 keV. So it's increasingly clear that we can actually discover accretion disks that are anomalously close. I mean, as it, by way of saying, it's a departure from what would be allowed for a Schwarzschild case, a non-rotating case. But it is anomalously close to the event horizon. And the only reasonable explanation for that is that the innermost stable circular orbit is anomalously close to the event horizon, which is only possible if the black hole is spinning. Now, this is like measuring voltages. It doesn't say how much energy is actually present in the black hole, if we do look at things very carefully. So, and the energy is what really is relevant, if at all, in GRBs. So let's have a look at a more tasteful picture on the energy in Kerr-Black holes. I made this up while on a trip to New Zealand to the Kerrfest, and they gave me this peanut bag in the air, in the airplane. And it's actually quite appropriate to a black hole because, well, the serving size is a handful of peanuts, a handful of solar masses. The energy is huge. They claim it was fairly healthy peanuts, so the fat total was extraordinarily... actually, it wasn't so little. It was about, from the rotational energy... Well, the... Let me see. So the rotational energy is actually... a fairly large fraction of the total energy in this case that can be liberated without any further contamination. So a rotating black hole in many ways is a very pure source of energy.
It's cholesterol free, I guess.
Yeah. I call it sugar free, but all else indeed cholesterol free, yeah. Now we do a simulation based on just using conservation laws of mass and angular momentum, and we track what happens in a core collapse event of a rotating star. We expect a black hole to form, and we expect the black hole to have some amount of angular momentum. So horizontally here is the spin period, and if one quarter corresponds to about one day, and one half is about a two-day period. You find indeed that, as I said, only on the basis of conservation laws, that the black hole that you form actually can be quite massive by way of a fraction of the progenitor core, say helium core of 10 solar masses. It's a fraction of order unity, and the rotational energy can reach several percent of the rest mass energy of your progenitor core. If you look at the rotational energy relative to the maximal rotational energy in the black hole, because Kerr black holes have a maximal spin rate, it can easily be of order 50%, somewhere between a third and two-thirds, depending on your approximation. So these black holes, when the progenitor star is spinning, and this is in an approximation of uniform rotation, can actually be fairly rapidly spinning, and so can be fairly energetic.
So when you did these simulations, do you assume like some kind of mass turn actually assume what happens to it, or is this a generic simulation?
Well, as I said, it's based only on conservation law. So it's a shell after shell accumulation into a nucleus, and you assume that there is no transport of mass or angular momentum between the shells. It's a very basic, rudimentary, but very clear-cut calculation. So you assume that the infall or the core collapse happens so quickly, in reality it's tens of seconds, right, that there is little time for diffusion of angular momentum. That's the approximation. So it gives you an order of magnitude feeling as to what kind of objects you may be forming.
No, but also, like, I was just going more that there are, like, plots like Alex Hager and all make where, say, if you have a certain amount of solar mass star, you can have this kind of a remnant left, and most of the remnants are actually, I don't know, Chris may know more about this, but they're, like, they're not that high in mass, the black holes and stuff and all, except if you go to very massive stars or something, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, well, here's the result, first of all, expressed in terms of a fraction. Okay, so it's normalized to the progenitor mass. So if your progenitor is not very massive, the black hole is not very massive. But there are more subtle issues, actually. To make this happen, the kick velocity of the black hole should be very small. And that actually perhaps is a more relevant or more interesting point. So I may or may not have time to touch upon that. So this is in a case of zero kick velocity, which is a very ideal case, and it has a very low probability of occurring. Now, spin energy is extractable, which is somewhat non-trivial. It was actually Penrose in 1969 who made this firm by using a Gedanken experiment. And once knowing this is this is the case, it will satisfy a very simple first law of thermodynamics, meaning there's total energy conservation. The total change in the mass energy is seen at infinity, which is the rest mass plus rotational energy, is changed according to the work that it does on the environment plus some entropy that you may create in the process. Now, the entropy that you may create in a black hole, while it is active, may actually be quite large, but it is a process that is completely unseen, because once you dissipate in the horizon by itself, that does not create any radiation for classical microscopic black holes. But the work that can be done using the usual angular velocity times change in angular momentum can be quite large, because the spin energy can be quite large. So my GRB hypothesis is that a GRB is produced by a rotating black hole, and as I was alluding to briefly, with a relatively small kick velocity in interaction with high density matter. And in many ways, it's like a process in which you're tying a knot around a rotating black hole. So let's see what are the consequences of this. Well, first of all, the interaction is mediated by magnetic fields, and that has an interesting history by itself. It goes back to 1975. In a very nice paper, Ruffini and Wilson pointed out the existence of horizon Maxwell stresses. It's a very clean paper. It's also very correct. That was, however, in a test limit of very weak magnetic fields, so all the particles that were discussed in that paper actually follow geodesic trajectories. So it points out an interesting physical process, but it is not directly applicable to a practical situation. So that was generalized to a force field limit, which is quite the opposite, in which you impose that there is a very strong magnetic field and particles are guided by the magnetic field alone and do not follow geodesics. By Blandford and Snyak, which has been considered to in various more realistic astrophysical configurations. And this has a long history, which continues today, and I'll just give you a few references. Now, what might this mean from a semi-quantitative perspective? So suppose we have a star. This is actually a real picture of Betelgeuse. But suppose we add some magnetic fields by hand, and we represent the magnetic field by magnetic current loops in the equatorial plane, and we let it collapse. Then we form a black hole, we remove the central part of the magnetic field, then by Stokes' theorem, these magnetic current loops are equivalent to two current loops by way of looking at a topology alone. You can put this in MATLAB and discover what is the magnetic field topology. So then it is shown here, where you have a torus that is carrying two opposite current rings. Each combined, they support two nested flux surfaces in and outside, which are separated by a separatrix. So the question now is, what kind of interaction does this produce between the black hole and the torus? Well, in fact, because there is no small parameter here, the black hole luminosity that is induced in this process is mostly incident on the torus. And again, by the first law of thermodynamics, it's easy to see that the efficiency then of energy transfer between the black hole and the torus is simply governed by the ratio of their angular velocities, which need not be small. It can easily be 10%. So that if you have, say, only order of 10 to the 4 ERCs in rotational energy, some 10 to the 53 ERCs is liberated in this process. And so the spin connection is by these open field lines between the torus and the black hole, and which in fact operates by equivalence to pulsars. In many ways, this horizon that is supported by the black hole is equivalent to an ordinary horizon at infinity, except that it has finite area and that it has an angular velocity which is fairly large and easily larger than that of the torus. Now, you can do some analysis on this. Perhaps first and foremost, a stability analysis on the magnetic field and the torus. You find that the magnetic field energy that the torus can support is about 1/15 of the kinetic energy in the torus. And so we further introduce a dimensionless mass expression for the torus, say the ratio of the mass of the torus to that of the black hole, and a relative rotational energy of the black hole, say the rotational energy that it has relative to its maximum set by the Kerr metric. You find expressions for the lifetime of spin of the black hole, it's on the order of tens of seconds, and also an expression for the luminosity of the black hole, which is large, it's on the order of 51 ERCs per second. Now, having matter receiving this much energy, the question is, how is this energy catalyzed and channeled into various radiation channels? So what we looked at is three channels that we believe are dominant. One is gravitational radiation, the second is winds. In fact, there will be baryon-rich winds mediated by a magnetic field, and MeV neutrinos. And so to study this, we balance the system of a black hole and a torus by way of balancing the angular momentum transport and the energy transport. And of course, you have to close this equation with some constitutive relation. So the question is, how much is dissipated or how much entropy is created in the torus in this process? Well, by dimensional analysis, this should scale as the relative angular velocity between, or shear angular velocity in the torus, so it's the difference between the angular velocity of the inner face and the outer face, squared, times the magnetic field squared, and then times the factor of order unity. And the picture here is that in this geometry of having a major radius A and a minor radius B, we assume, it's based on one assumption on the spectrum of MHD turbulence. This is, of course, not well understood from first principle or even from numerical simulations. However, what we believe is the case is that this spectrum will actually be fairly flat in the infrared and will have a break at a characteristic azimuthal mode number M star, which is set by the aspect ratio of the torus. It's a purely geometrical argument. And if you use this, you can actually solve the equations. And you find that there is a positive solution for gravitational wave luminosity, provided that you have sufficiently strong differential rotation and or the viscosity is sufficiently strong. So positive solutions exist for gravitational radiation. Now, this produces a whole folklore or rainbow of emissions from the torus, which we can analyze by way of energy for the various quantities of interest, in particular the gravitational radiation, the wind energy, and the total energy dissipated, which will be released mostly in MV neutrinos, integrated over time so that we can look at total energies. And the one that, as expected, perhaps a priori, is the largest is the output in gravitational radiation. Second is the energy output in MEV winds, and at an intermediate level is second is the MEV winds, and at a second order is the energy in winds. Now the torus, especially being subject to so much torques and energetic interactions, is probably not going to be axisymmetric. And so it's interesting to look at various channels that may create non-axisymmetric tori. And one of them is a fairly well-known mechanism introduced by Poplawski-Pringle in 1984. Poplawski-Pringle studied the interaction of two wave patterns on the inner phase and the outer phase of the torus that are propagating with opposite orientation. And you can study this by way of incompressible fluid dynamics and find that the torus becomes unstable when it is sufficiently slender, and as it becomes more slender, more modes become unstable. And if we look at the Rayleigh number, the critical value for Rayleigh stability, which is m equals zero, you can read off various characteristic numbers. In particular, you will have an m equals 2 instability, which is relevant for gravitational radiation, when the ratio of minor to major radius is slightly less than 0.4. A second and independent instability mechanism may be due to magnetic moment interactions. And so if we study this by way of having a model, a one-dimensional model of a ring of magnetic moments, then there are various interactions that magnetic moments introduce to each other. You can have buckling instabilities, for example, that are studied here. And you can ask, well, numerically, not analytically, what then will be the spectrum of the mass moments that are introduced by these instabilities. And so what we find is a spectrum like this for the mass moment moments introduced. And the good news about this simulation is that the largest mass inhomogeneity is actually the m equals 2 inhomogeneity, so that in fact most of the gravitational wave emission is produced by the quadrupole moment. And so the gravitational wave output is this expression, where we have scaled it to xi is 0.01, which gives luminosities based on numerical simulations that are consistent with the theoretical estimate in the suspended accretion state. So these are two completely independent analyses. One is purely numerical to see what magnetic instability naturally gives for the mass inhomogeneities and hence the luminosity. And the other one assumes that there is a complete balance between energy and angular momentum input and output in the various radiation channels. And so these two results are thus far consistent. So what we have here as a picture is that when you form a black hole in a rotating star, say with spin period on the order of a day, initially, in fact, there is a Kerr constraint that tells you cannot form a black hole. You must form some non-axisymmetric ring, which is too rich in angular momentum. After this ring has diluted its angular momentum, the ring is allowed to collapse to a black hole. The collapse process then allows the black hole to surge to very high mass, basically on a free fall time scale. It's a slightly modified Bondi accretion of matter that has relatively low angular momentum, up to a point where the matter that falls in stalls against an angular momentum barrier. And at that point, you can have either continuing spin up slowly by, if you wish, the Bardeen accretion process, or the black hole starts to interact strongly with the surrounding matter, loses its spin energy, and in the process, the torus emits lots of gravitational radiation. So, well, the supernovae associated with GRBs, especially in the 1998 BW case, which has now been studied by various groups, appear to be fairly aspherical. This was also part of a discussion of this program. And if you look at the fate of the output of the energy in winds, which is on the order of 52 ERCs, and this is largely carried by a magnetic wind, which ultimately will be dissipated into radiation, then the picture that arises is a nucleus that, after tens of seconds, has already died out, that has basically inflated the whole star with lots of radiation that is then impinging on the inner side of the remnant envelope. This radiation is very aspherical, simply because the inner engine is. And so you have a powerful photon luminosity impacting these remnants. Chris actually called this a photon wind in his earlier work with Colgate and Pinto, which, while the remnant is still optically thick, produces ejecta, and ultimately, after expansion, the envelope becomes optically thin and the radiation can leak out. You can then ask, what is the total energy in the ejecta? It's a simple calculation to find that by simply using momentum conservation, that the kinetic energy in the supernova ejecta in this way is on the order of 10 to the 51 ERCs. Now, concerning the other elements that are, if we look at the torus again surrounding the black hole and the magnetic fields that it supports, so far we've looked at the direct interaction between the black hole and the torus, but it turns out that if we move, by topological argument, the separatrix along the spin axis to infinity, one is actually creating an open model where there is now magnetic field lines that have radiated boundary conditions both to infinity and on the horizon of the black hole. In fact, so you have a double structure for the outflow of the jet. You have a baryon-poor outflow, and you have a baryon-rich wind supported by the torus. And Lemonson and Eichler asked themselves the question, what then would be the baryon-loading process by way of flux of neutrons from the baryon-rich wind to the baryon-poor jet? This is a way to increase the entropy and to arrive at a finite Lorentz factor. Well, because of time, I'll keep it short, but if you have a blob of charged matter in this open flux tube with a certain angular momentum, it actually interacts with the frame dragging produced by the black hole and creates powerful ejecta. If these ejecta are time dependent, these shells will collide, and you can simulate this. And one of them observations is that when you have shells colliding in higher dimensions rather than in using planar symmetry, it also introduces a splash sidewards with accompanying shocks. So actually there are four shocks in this, or three shocks in this picture. Two are the planar shocks that you find in a standard Riemann problem, plus a surrounding shock, somewhat weaker, surrounding the GRB, producing internal shocks in the jet. In this picture, we can look at the, maybe I should skip this because of time, the luminosity. So let me just summarize this so far, that the GRB hypothesis of Kerr black holes interacting with high density matter produce gravitational waves and MeV neutrinos through the surrounding torus, It also produces a strong baryon pore output along the spin axis, plus a baryon rich wind supported by the torus. And to summarize the energetics, so the starting point is the rotational energy of the black hole. Most of it actually disappears unseen in the event horizon. A small fraction is emitted along the spin axis in the form of baryon pore outflows, making a GRB. A much larger fraction is mediated to the torus, which, by way of its nature, has many channels of radiating this energy into gravitational radiation, torus winds, thermal and MEV neutrinos, and also a substantial torus mass loss. And the remainder is of the torus winds is converted into radiation, radiating the remnant envelope from within, perhaps being also by its nature of having making high energy photons, creating X-ray line emissions by fluorescence. But the main point here to take home is that there is an extra energy in gravitational radiation, which can easily be 1,000 times the total energy, the true energy in gamma rays. And so more quantitatively, the prediction or the prospect for LIGO is as follows. If you look at the LIGO strain amplitude curves for the noise, then currently we are at this level, the initial LIGO and the initial Virgo. The advanced LIGO and Virgo are plotted here. They are about tenfold times smaller in amplitude. The prediction for the gravitational wave amplitude of the GRB supernova is a two-parameter area in the graph, depending on the mass of the black hole and the angular velocity of the torus. So you see that for initial LIGO and Virgo, the signal-to-noise ratio would be of order 1. So we don't expect to see anything today or tomorrow. But if we go to advanced LIGO, then the signal-to-noise ratio could easily be appropriate for a detection, say, once per year within a distance of 100 megaparsec. If you add up all these events over the entire universe, knowing the cosmological event rate, we get a typical omega b relative to the closure density in the stochastic background radiation produced by these events on the order of 10 to the minus 8. So here you see the picture of the various detectors with their characteristic 90 degree angle between the various laser beams. Virgo is 3 kilometers long, LIGO is 4 kilometers long, and there's also GEO 600, which is 600 meters long. They all operate by the same principle, laser interferometry under 90 degrees.
So it's two different LIGO?
Yeah, there are two sites for LIGO. Yeah.
Where is Virgo?
Pisa.
And where's advanced LIGO located?
Oh, it's the same. It's yeah, they made everything large enough such that you can exchange all the internal equipment so that the actual civil engineering part of the entire construction stays the same. So the proposal we have by way of looking for curved black holes is to use LIGO and Virgo detections to perform calorimetry on their gravitational wave emissions in long duration GRBs. And so this offers a way to get energetic calorimetric evidence for the spin energy in the black hole in a GRB supernova, and hence evidence for the presence of curved black holes. Now, just a final comment on short GRBs. So if short GRBs are also produced by spin energy of a black hole, and the short time duration is accounted for by attributing that to hyperaccretion, say in a black hole neutron-star coalescence process, then you expect short GRBs also to have afterglows. Furthermore, if it's a hyperaccreting system, in particular there is no progenitor star surrounding it, you expect the entire event to be described by a more compact geometry and hence larger opening angles for the emissions. And so there is a tentative evidence for this based on a few events that show relatively large opening angles to the short GRB emissions. So the promise for the and the work to do for the near future is to map out a transient universe in gravitational waves and electromagnetic waves. And perhaps it is of interest to look for combined efforts using the upcoming surveys in the electromagnetic spectrum, say by Pan-STARRS, GLAST, LOFAR in the radio, and possibly in combination with high-energy neutrino detectors, IceCube and Antares. So just by way of example, suppose we detect tens of thousands of supernovae per year using these optical radio whole sky transient surveys, then about a few tens of these, perhaps in the form of radio loud supernovae 1BCs, are candidate events of long GRBs. And so this kind of strategy would give you fairly specific coordinated targets of opportunity for LIGO and Virgo data analysis, precisely those that you think are candidate GRB events. So we hope that there will be a collaboration between the LIGO and Virgo community and the ENM survey community to make this more concrete. So let me take some questions from here. Thanks.
Ice Cube is South Pole.
Mediterranean. It's in the.
Is it the ocean one?
Yeah. South of France. Yeah.
That was normal LIGO. You cannot yet do anything interesting. How near should it be to see something else?
The present LIGO has a sensitivity range for Nipsonissa coalescence somewhat less than 20 megaparsecs, on the order of 10. If you that means that I calculated this once, the equivalent sensitivity range for a GRB supernova is then slightly larger, but it's still not reaching, say, Virgo. So it would still be insufficient.
So you would like to reach the very, very close to Earth at least?
At the very least, yeah.
So I guess I don't know much about this, but there are several different models that people have talked about even this for, like progenitors of GRBs and stuff and all. This assumes that you have to have a black rotating black hole and stuff and all. If there's anything else, then does that mean that you just don't have any gravitational radiation?
No, because as I said, there are at least two sources of energy for powering gravitational radiation. One is just the infall of matter, the kinetic energy that's liberated in this process, combined with the angular momentum that it carries along.
But you need something that.
But it turns out to be not very efficient.
You need something that'll give you a big quadrupole moment.
Yes, that's the whole key. You need a quadrupole moment that is tens of a percent. Say 10-20% of your mass distribution. So it's almost an order unity mass inhomogeneity. You need a very powerful mechanism to create very strong mass inhomogeneities. And if you have a hyperaccreting system, that's much less likely to happen. That's one reason. So there are two aspects. One is to create large mass inhomogeneities, and the second is to have an energy source sustaining these inhomogeneities even while they are so luminous in gravitational radiation. So this energy source, you know, the 10 to 53 ERCs coming out of the black hole, is not easily received from something else.
So are there any models like with the progenitors where some wave which give you a lot more gravitational waves and some which would give you nothing at all, so you wouldn't see it?
No, it's hard to get more than this. This is actually very high. For example, if you look at a type 2 super, take the 1987A. Okay, so if that happened today, for example, it would be wonderful because it's so nearby that even if you have an energy output of, say, 10 to the minus 6 solar mass, it might give you a candidate event for LIGO. You know, 50 kiloparsec or versus 50 megaparsec, that's a big difference. So if you look for very nearby events, it's not so subtle. You can have many ways to make enough gravitational radiation. But to be at this distance, you need to have a very powerful mechanism.
Can the gravitational waves do something also in producing the gamma ray burst itself? Is there a coupling? Can we make enough coupling to matter that they do something interesting in the source? Also?
Well, formally, the interaction is non-zero. I mean, if you have a perturbation of space-time and you have some plasma, then there's always some coupling. But the interaction is weak and is, of course, very low frequency. So if you combine those, I mean, this is audio range, right? So if you combine the two, there's not much chance to make that happen.
But you move and your momentum, so you might change the evolution. Can you change the evolution, or does it? So I have, and you're moving your momentum. Is it enough to change the angular momentum considerably, so that if I looked at the evolution over 100 seconds, the momentum profile would look different as it evolves?
Of the black hole?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the black hole, see, there is a dissipative time scale here, which is this spin down of the black hole. So yeah, the black hole slowly spins, gradually spins slower and slower. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, I was just wondering.
Yeah, we calculated that. It's about 45 seconds. Yeah, here's the spin time scale. Yeah, so it's tens of seconds for canonical parameters. And that was actually fairly encouraging. So now you might ask, for example, what is the impact of having gradual change of the spin rate of the black hole, say, on this whole configuration? I mean, it's still two parts, so the torus radius, for example, might change slowly. So that's an unknown.
So this could set the time scale for a long burst.
That's what we use. Yeah, we say, okay, let's identify the lifetime of rapid spin with the duration of the burst term. Now, that's not true for the application to short GRBs, because there it's probably, it will spin down a little bit slower, of course, after the event, but probably it's cut off by the fact that the hyperaccretion is so fast that you absorb the Nip star so quickly that time scale of absorbing the neutron star is shorter than the spin down time scale, is our guess. Or they are the same, I mean, either way. The reason why also this is fairly long is because you expect the torus around the black hole to be, say, a tenth of a solar mass. Now, the colloidal magnetic field energy that it can support is no more than 10% of the kinetic energy in that matter. So if you combine that, the interaction is relatively weak. As far as the black hole is concerned, this is a weak interaction.
Why is the mass of the torus so small? Couldn't it be larger?
Not for not in the core collapse event. That's fairly easy to see. I mean, you're not going to have more than 10 to the 11 grams per cubic centimeter, unless you start out with something much higher, like a neutron star. You can just calculate what is the compression factor if you let it collapse.
You could not make a 10 solar mass black hole with a 2 solar mass torus or something.
Not in a core collapse. Yeah. I mean, I don't see how that would happen. Maybe Chris knows something.
So what were the disks that we were talking about last week, where you had the fallback and stuff, and we were talking about the
solar mass disks?
Solar mass, that was the solar mass, right?
By assumption.
Well, I don't know. This I thought, I don't know if the assumption came from a model or
was it a natural number?
What do you
mean? Well, so in the rotating model we're looking at right now, do you know how much? I mean, defining it, yes, it's hard, but
yeah.
I would guess it's a few tenths of a solar mass around a 1.5 solar mass neutron star. So the ratio there is probably at the order of 0.2. But it's because it's a low mass compact object. I had to look at, I mean, yeah.
No, but I thought most of the assumptions, most of the things we saw last week on the neutrino and neutron were based on much higher masses than.
So.
Yeah,
so definitely the stuff that Henry McFadden got, it was a low mass disk around the black hole, like a few tenths of a solar mass of disk around a 3 solar mass black hole. And so that's smaller than the number I just gave. I would have to look and see if I can get a solar mass disk around a.
Like Rebecca's stuff and all we had last week, I thought they assumed much higher, so that was a pretty high assumption, than you think? Or?
No, I don't know. I don't really know, so I don't know if that's high or not.
Yeah, that's what
I
remember.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Certainly you're feeding the disk pretty heavily, and then the question is how well does the disk take that and put it onto the black hole? So if it can, but you know, for the low mass accretion rates, densities of what you were saying, 10 or 11 grams per centimeter cubed, that's roughly right. So then you, so certainly 10, 11 is a good density for the disk.
She was accreting 1 solar mass per second.
1 to 10, I think she used. Yeah.
But it would help you if it were a disk of solar mass. Is that so?
Well, it would of course spin down the black hole a little bit faster.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's good or bad.
Would you get more gravitational waves?
No, because that is determined, if you integrate over the duration, it's not just luminosity that's important, because it's true, the luminosity will be higher, but the duration will be shorter. So if you just take the integrated quantities, the total energies, that only depends on the initial rotational energy in the black hole and the efficiency, which is simply set by the ratio of the angular velocity of the torus to the black hole. So it doesn't care about the magnetic field strength, it doesn't care about the total mass, in a way, within limits.
On Earth, if the luminosity is higher, you
well, the real relevant quantity is the total energy.
Is that?
Yeah. If you smear it out over more time or less time, it doesn't matter too much. Because of the square root of n. No, but because if you want to do your correlation. So a weak signal smeared out over a long time, many, many wave periods. Is recoverable to some extent by the square root of the number of wave periods. So short and powerful, or long and extended but moderate strength, can easily be equivalent.
So it does not help to make bigger fields?
No, what's really important actually is the frequency, because if you look at from a detection perspective, if you look at the well, and that's what you may not want, depending on where you are. So if you see, if you look at the frequency at maximal sensitivity or frequency at lowest instrumental noise, is roughly the same for initial and advanced LIGO, and as you can see, it's on the order of 100 to 200 hertz. So if you release things by a big bang in a very short period, then you move, and if that would mean you're moving it up in frequency, it's not a good thing. Okay, so you'd rather be well, we are, this kind of model never gets you to 200 hertz, as you can see. But say a typical frequency would be around 500 hertz. It's much better to be here than to be at 800 hertz.
So you would like an even smaller frequency?
Well, that depends on... See, the main unknown... So actually, in fact, the mass of the black hole is not too much of an unknown... In principle, it's not an unknown parameter, although it has a distribution, simple astrophysical distribution. But the real unknown in the model is this ratio of the angular velocity of the torus to the black hole. Okay, so that... And that is not clear how that depends on the mass, for example, of the torus. It's not clear what it depends on at all. So it probably depends on the microphysics of how the matter behaves, how much quadruple moment it actually can produce through, say, the nonlinear interactions that it has. I gave two examples of instabilities. So again, if it depends on its dependence on the mass of the torus, whether it moves it in the right or the wrong direction. So that's why there might actually be a possibility of seeing the stochastic background, the contribution to the stochastic background radiation gravitational waves from this population, because the redshift in this case helps. With a typical redshift of 1 or 2, you're moving the frequencies down by a factor of 2 or 3. Okay, so and that puts you right in the range of lowest instrumental noise, which is really a coincidence. So it's not really clear whether, for example, if you do a one-year campaign, this contribution to the stochastic background radiation is, if you wish, more detectable than an individual burst event that might take place at 100 megaparsec, which also takes 1 year. And it's only because you're looking with this very skewed eye of the instrument. So that's why it would be very practical if you have a way of if you have these tens of thousands of supernovae that should be up and coming in the next 2 years, if you have an efficient way of down selecting those to GRB candidates. Because suppose you have 100 of them, then you have 100 targets for your data analysis, one by one. If you believe they're all luminous gravitational waves, you just add them up, you shift them all to the same T0. And you look for that contribution, it's a Poisson still, it's still a stochastic, it's an incoherent superposition, of course, of the signals. But it would be an interesting study to do that, because it would still give you more gravitational wave signal, even if it's asynchronous addition. So there are many ways you can do smart games, or smart searches, if you wish, for gravitational waves that will just play themselves out over the years.
So all these new transient detectors which you mentioned are very important?
I believe so, yeah. And it's very important to make a link between these two communities, because maybe either one is not up to date perhaps, or doesn't know what are the possibilities of exploiting each other's advantages and capabilities. Yeah, there is, but it's very modest. You know, it's on the order of 50% or something. So fortunately, for all practical purposes, it's isotropic. Okay.